Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, the only thing bringing this continent together apart from the European Tram Driving Championships.
Oh, bold claim.
Which I got completely obsessed with this week. Who knew that tram driving was competitive?
This is the video that you posted on Twitter of a tram sort of pushing this big bouncy ball and knocking over some Skittles, is that right?
Yes, they play tram Skittles and they do emergency brake tests. And just like with Eurovision, Australia somehow managed to weasel their way into this European competition.
How did they get an Australian tram over here? I have so many questions.
We'll just have to wait until next year comes around and then do a whole like special mini series about the European Tram Driving Championships.
Deal.
Have you been, Katie, since I saw you? We had a very nice few days together in Berlin, didn't we?
We had a lovely team meetup in Berlin, yeah. Dominic and I and our producers, Katz and Wojciech, we stayed in the world's strictest Airbnb. There were rules about everything, including a 35-euro fine if we left a single cup unwashed. But I think that made it feel extra special when we got this really nice glowing review from the hosts saying that we were exemplary guests. We really followed those rules.
We did, it's true, although I did come back with COVID again.
Well, I'm glad in a way that you're trapped in the house because it means you have two podcasts with me. What have we got coming up this week, Dominic?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about something that, frankly, I feel like we should be talking about more often, even if it can sometimes feel pretty terrifying and impossible to solve. We're talking about disinformation online and how to defeat it. We'll be calling up Diana Filimon in Romania, who runs an NGO called Forum Apulum that has been fighting to strengthen democracy in Romania for many years now, in part by teaching young people to become better equipped at spotting disinformation and misinformation online. And obviously, since Putin began Russia's full-blown invasion of Ukraine just over 90 days ago, her work has become even more important. She is now working a lot in Moldova, where there is a huge Russian campaign of disinformation. This interview is really worth sticking around for and telling all your friends about, because we need to be more aware of what's going on if anything is going to improve. That's coming up later on the show. But first, it's a German special Good Week, Bad Week.
Yeah.
Good week. Bad week.
Who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for Germans after Germany's upper house of parliament approved a law that will, from the 1st of June, that's next week, provide very cheap public transport across a lot of the public transport system in Germany for a whole 3 months. The deal is that you pay €9, and with that ticket, you have unlimited access to all local and regional public transport in Germany. Buses, metros, trains. It doesn't include long-distance trains and buses, but even without those services, considering a monthly pass for transport in all three zones of Berlin costs €107 a month, this is a pretty amazing deal.
I mean, it sounds amazing. Presumably, this has been brought in because of the pretty terrible cost of living crisis at the moment.
Yeah, the cost of living crisis is a big reason behind this policy. It will save people who already use public transport a significant amount of cash each month. It's also expected to persuade large numbers of people who would normally take the car not to, and to go by public transport instead, which should, A, have some effect on lowering Germany's demand for energy imports, in the best case scenario, helping to bring down energy prices and or helping Germany wean itself off Russian gas. And B, it will be good for the climate, keeping polluting cars off the road and persuading people to use less polluting forms of transport. It's a win-win situation.
I feel like, as always, there's a catch coming with this good week. What's the catch?
Why does there always need to be a catch? But yes, of course, there is some criticism of this policy, not necessarily a catch. And there are concerns from some that the already packed German public transport system will not be able to cope with all these extra travellers, that there won't be space for wheelchair users or parents with prams, for example. And this could indeed be the case in some places. But the transport providers are trying to get ahead of it. They're putting on extra trains and massively increasing the number of service and security staff on duty. We'll have to see how successful they are at managing this extra capacity and quite how many people are going to take up the deal before we can judge if it's a success. There are also actually some specific parts of the country that are particularly nervous about being overrun with people who wouldn't normally visit because it's normally too expensive to visit. One place that there's been a lot of chatter about online is this island of Sylt, which is a picturesque island in the north of Germany near the border with Denmark. It's an island that has quite an elitist image. It's often visited by millionaires and billionaires, and it's sometimes referred to as the German Hamptons. But there was an article in the German tabloid Bild a few weeks ago suggesting that locals were terrified of the coming onslaught of people who would be using this €9 monthly ticket deal to make journeys to Sylt that they would never have considered before. This article naturally led to a huge wave of humiliation online and wonderful memes.
Oh, because was the Bild article saying like, oh no, the poor residents are going to have to deal with the hoi polloi coming in? Was it that kind of thing?
It was that kind of tone, yes. But also with a bit of tongue in cheek, I think. But actually, the memes eventually led to a Facebook page being set up in German called Chaos Days Sylt 2022, encouraging people to head to Sylt for a summer-long chaotic party. And in all seriousness, there are anti-capitalist campaigners who think this is an opportunity for the island to be taken back for the people and enjoyed by everyone, which, yeah, aside from the chaotic partying, there is an argument that it should be able to be enjoyed by everyone. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, also concerns from locals that there simply isn't the capacity for tons of extra people on the island. There are only actually 60,000 beds on the island. Anyway, this is a bit of a tangent, but it's just one example of a place where locals are a bit nervous about what will happen when transport becomes so cheap. And in all honesty, nobody really knows what will happen. I sure hope it will be slightly less apocalyptic than some of the people of Sylt seem to be afraid of.
Really important question from me, your penny-pinching friend. What if you've already paid for like some really expensive monthly transport card before you knew there was a good deal on?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. That's also something I was concerned about.
Thank you.
And it looks like the public transport bodies are going to refund those people so that they're not paying more than the €9. So it's all good.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But for the government, this must presumably be super expensive, no? Especially if they're laying on like loads of extra staff and trains and stuff.
Yeah, the government has budgeted $2.5 billion for this. That money will go towards paying back the transport providers for lost income, including those refunded subscriptions that you were worried about. And it will cover the cost of administering the scheme. I'm fascinated to see how it goes over the summer, if the transport system can deal with it, and how the demand for energy in Germany is affected by the policy. Environmental groups seem generally pleased with the policy. Some are critical of the fact that it is coming into force just as the government is also planning on lowering fuel duties considerably for car drivers. Mm. On the other hand, some of the country is just not well enough connected by public transport currently. So cars will still be necessary for some to go about their daily lives. Mm-hmm. The availability of public transport in rural areas is something that this policy is not doing anything about. And that's another piece of criticism. Anyway, before I move on, I didn't feel I could talk about German transport this week without also mentioning a pretty awful story that I read about the Berlin public transport system this week. An American-German opera singer who lives in Berlin is taking the Berlin Transport Company to court for discrimination after a pretty horrific-sounding incident with some ticket inspectors in 2020, in which he says he was pushed down on a metal bench after a ticket inspector said, "Black Lives Matter is only an excuse for you."
Oh, Jesus.
He ended up having to go to hospital to get his wounds in his forearm and thigh treated. And he's not the only person who's accused the Berlin ticket inspectors of discrimination, of singling out people of colour, and of physical abuse. I'll put a link to Philip Altermann's article from last weekend's Observer, which goes into much more detail about the background of this particular horrifying sounding situation.
Please do.
Cheer us up with bad week, Katie. Who's had a bad week?
I'll try. We're staying in Germany for bad week. It is that rare German double bill that you talked about, because it has been a bad week for cat owners in the town of Waldorf in southwestern Germany. And weirdly, this is another story about a German policy that runs until the end of August, specifically.
Oh.
Because cat owners in the southern part of this town have been told that their cats are not allowed outside until the end of August. The cats are on lockdown.
Oh God, is this is there a horrible disease spreading around the cats now?
No, it's not a disease thing. It's to do with the fact that cats are vicious hunters, much as we love them. The reason the cats are being put on lockdown is to protect a bird, the crested lark. They're very cute. I don't know if you want to Google them, but they've got this kind of punky hairstyle that makes them look really angry. They're quite funny. And they're also really good at singing, like you, in fact, Dominic. And they're good at imitating other birds, which is kind of interesting. Would you like to hear a crested lark?
I'd love to.
Here you go.
That's a lovely noise. And the haircut is great.
Isn't it?
So I'm presuming the cats are being put on lockdown because these birds are super endangered?
Well, worldwide, they're not actually officially super endangered. On the Red List, which is the world's best known database for tracking threatened animals, the crested lark is listed as a species of least concern. But within Europe, their population has been going down really sharply in recent years. The data's kind of patchy and it needs updating, but everywhere from Spain to Poland has recorded sharp declines over the past few decades. And within Germany, they are listed as threatened with extinction. And within this town, they are very, very threatened. There's only 3 breeding pairs left, apparently.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's bad.
Do we know why they're in decline? Is it the cats?
Well, cats certainly are not the only culprit. Most bird experts think it's connected with intensive agriculture. That old chestnut, both in terms of the way that intensive farming has got rid of the kind of vegetation where these birds like to make their homes, and also potentially the use of pesticides as well. But BirdLife International, on their website, they say that there needs to be more research on why this is happening.
So how has this cat lockdown gone down with the owners in the town and the cats? I don't know if you managed to speak to any of them.
Not directly. But yeah, surprise, surprise, they are not very happy. So the reason for the cat lockdown is that the district conservation authorities say that the local situation for these birds is so serious that they really need to protect every single baby chick. So they can't risk even a single cat doing that thing where they bring a half-dead bird back to the house as a lovely gift to their owners. Mm. And in the case of this species of bird, that's a particularly high risk because crested larks make their nests in holes in the ground. So they're easy prey for cats. Oh. And the conservation authority says it's been tracking the larks really closely in this area. And they have unfortunately had some cases of cats mauling these birds. But the cat owners are saying it's really disproportionate to lock cats in the house for 3 months. And not even just this year. The plan is to do this for 3 months every year for 3 years. So they're furious. And the authorities have suggested a couple of workarounds, including walking your cat on a lead. But a lot of people, especially working people, are saying they're just not going to be able to give their cats the amount of exercise that they would normally get roaming around. And that's really going to stress the cats out.
Is there some kind of punishment for the owners that decide to let their cats out anyway?
Yeah, and it's pretty intense. If your cat is found roaming around outside during this lockdown period, you get a €500 fine. And if your cat is caught in the act with a crested lark in its mouth, you could get fined up to 50,000 euros.
Oh my goodness.
I know. And there's quite a lot of cat owners affected by this order. The mayor estimates that it's about 3,000 homes, so probably hundreds of pet cats. And he himself is not super enthusiastic about this policy. It's not the town hall that's ordered this, it's the local conservation authority. And actually, it's important to point out that even within the animal rights world, this plan hasn't won universal support. Deutscher Tierschutzbund, which is Germany's largest animal welfare group, they told Euronews that even though they obviously think that this bird needs to be protected, you have to weigh it up against the welfare of all animals, and in this case, hundreds of cats. And their health and general well-being is going to suffer if they're cooped up for 3 months of the year. They also had another good argument against this policy, which I'll read to you. They said, defining domestic cats as culprits for the endangerment of certain bird species means letting them take the blame for the fact that humans have destroyed habitats and food supplies for wild species over a long period of time. Mm. So, is it really fair to make cats pay the price for something that's mostly humans' fault? Anyway, this is not the end of the road, because apparently Volker Strutz, who is the local animal protection chief, he is taking legal action to challenge this ruling, so we'll see where it goes. But I thought that even though the story is, on the face of it, kind of quirky, it's kind of a cat version of the debate over human lockdowns that we've all been wrestling with for the past few years. It's an ethical argument over whether it's right and good to ask a big group to restrict their liberties, sometimes in ways that harms them if a minority is in really serious danger. So there you go, a little bit of cat philosophy for you this week.
There's going to be a lot of cats scratching on doors and meowing.
I think so, and a lot of ruined upholstery.
We had a very nice time meeting in Berlin last week with our producers in person for the first time ever. And we have big plans for this show, plans that will only be possible if you continue to support us on Patreon. I really actually do mean that. So if you have some spare cash, then why not throw it our way? Head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Or if you find Patreon complicated, you can also make a one-off donation on the support page of our website, Europeanspodcast.com.
This week, we would like to thank the latest generous listeners who've given us a helping hand by sending us a little bit of cash. Maya Smirkol, Raphael F. Font, Elizabeth Quiroz, Noble, and Fanny Bucarel for increasing her pledge.
Thank you, everyone.
If people haven't got any spare cash, there are other ways that they can help out. And one of those ways is telling a friend about our existence so that we could grow our audience. And I was thinking that this week, because I was looking at the data of where our audience is, and only 1% of our listeners are in Sweden, which seems like not very much. So this week, I would like to propose that people listening to this find a Swede and tell them about this podcast. What do you think?
I like this idea. And then we can see whether the stats change.
Now that I've said find a Swede and tell them about this podcast, I'm imagining people going to the supermarket and picking up a like cabbage-type Swede and saying, listen to the Europeans.
We'll take any listeners we can get.
Vegetable or animal? Do you remember that brief period last year when I worked as a technology journalist?
Yes, I do.
So do I, with fond and less fond memories. But one of my main takeaways from that period was just how much less social media companies based in Silicon Valley care about the spread of misinformation and disinformation in poorer countries and non-Anglophone countries. And in recent weeks, it really feels like there's been a prime example of that unfolding in front of our eyes with pretty dangerous potential consequences. I think a lot of us who use sites like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, a lot of us have seen the odd example of misinformation or propaganda relating to the war in Ukraine. But in some parts of Europe, the amount of propaganda that is being pumped into people's timelines about the war, it is just immense. And it's pretty clear that the social media sites, they just don't have the teams of moderators nearly big enough to cope with the scale of this problem in Russian and Romanian and other languages. And we're not talking about this problem enough in the rest of Europe. So this week, we wanted to talk about the information war that is being waged in Ukraine's neighbours, specifically Moldova. For those of you a little rusty on the geography, Moldova is surrounded on three sides by Ukraine. The war could not be closer. And Moldovan families are currently hosting about 100,000 refugees, which is a lot for a small country. And as you might have seen in the news recently, one of the reasons that the situation is so delicate in Moldova is that there's a region on the Ukrainian border called Transnistria that declared itself an independent country back in the 90s. No country has recognized it, but the authorities there are backed by Russia. What does any of this have to do with the misinformation that is turning up on TikTok and Facebook in Moldova? Well, quite a lot, actually. And we were put in touch this week with someone who has seen the problem up close. Diana Filimon is the head of Forum Apollum. It's a Romanian NGO that tries to encourage young people to think critically and become good citizens. And recently she's been working with young people in both Romania and Moldova who've been on the receiving end of pro-Russian propaganda. Diana just explained really, really clearly to us why we should all care about this. We gave her a call at home in Alba Iulia. You have been working a lot with young people in Moldova, as well as your home country of Romania. What kind of things have young people in these countries been seeing on their mobile phones since the war broke out across the border in Ukraine?
They saw adults panicking, people like them making passports and looking for a plan B to evacuate, both in some areas of Romania and also in Moldova. So they saw a lot of uncertainty and fear, and that made things worse for them and increased anxiety. It started to cool down now a bit, but it's still lingering in the air.
Do you think that media literacy is at an all-time low right now?
I think the attacks on people with less media literacy level are the highest level I have seen. I'm working on media literacy and working with teenagers for almost 6 years now. And I have never seen such a huge wave of attacks, especially in Moldova. Moldova is considered, from the propaganda point of view of Russian propaganda, a battleground right now, and has been this way since the day one of the war. It's on TikTok, Instagram, is wherever they are. So we are fighting to help them to ask the initial question. Is this true? Should I check it?
Can you give us a couple of examples of propaganda that you've seen coming across people's timelines?
In Moldova, the main, let's say, topic they started targeting in the beginning of the war was that the Ukrainian refugees are doing harm in Moldova, and that the level of comfort of life in Moldova would be affected by the refugees. That was the main point of disinformation, to make them push away Ukrainians, to say that they are endangering themselves by helping Ukrainian refugees. In Romania, the echo was, if we are a NATO country and we have military bases and we are helping refugees, will we be attacked? Because we are the country closest to the war front. They started pushing the agenda in the beginning that if you're helping your enemy's enemy, you become a target. But in Romania, it faded away. And in Moldova, I think it didn't have the right impact that which they expected. But this is the main message. And they are pushing that Ukrainians, they must have done something. So we should just leave them. We should leave them to settle their things with Russia, because they're not innocent and they shouldn't come here, and they should mind their own business like we should mind our own business. The end point, let's say, end game is for us to not care about Ukraine anymore, to look in our own lives and to look for holidays and for new clothes and to just don't be bothered about what's happening there.
You've been developing strategies to help particularly young people, teaching critical thinking and media literacy. Could you tell us a bit about some of those strategies and how they work?
I still haven't found the perfect one. I think that talking to them from the same level is the most important thing. If you're talking to the kids or to the teenagers like an adult, then you've lost them. They don't care what you're going to say, because you are like their teachers, like their parents, like their family, that's always preaching to them and say that they don't know enough anyway, because they haven't lived enough. So the first step is to talk to them like you would talk to your friends at a beer. Second of all is to try to make them your partners, because I always tell them, you may not be victims because you are media literate more than your grandparents and other older relatives, let's say, or unprivileged people. So we will need you to help us give this message to those people. So we are empowering them to not just look on their feed with an idea of not everything is true, but to also take care of the elder people. So in this way, you not only preaching to them the rules, you're also giving them a role in this story. So this is a story of good and evil, let's say, and you want to let them know they're on the right side and their contribution really matters. If they convince one or two people to not spread this information or to double check things, then it's already one person less for the disinformation campaigns to fall as a victim.
As you say, teenagers are probably in general better equipped than their parents and grandparents to sort fact from fiction, potentially, in terms of what they see online. But I was trying to figure out what the media landscape is like in Moldova. Is there a lot of critical media that can help correct the misinformation that's out there? Or is there a lot of kind of pro-Russian media that is reinforcing this kind of message?
I think it's a mix, but the good guys, I think they're very well represented, but they have a very tough fight. The problem is not just media, because in Moldova, soon after the war started, government issued a law in order to ban any Russian propaganda as much as possible. So this is from the mainstream media, but the propaganda doesn't work on mainstream media. Propaganda is on TikTok channels that appeared 2 days ago, or on Instagram, where you would expect to see just pictures of cats and dogs and whatever, but you are exposed to Russian propaganda. On WhatsApp groups, on Telegram groups, which you cannot trace, you cannot find the source of the rumor. So that's where the propaganda is working. So if you control the media and you have the best people in media possible, you will still have a huge problem. So my colleagues from Watchdog Moldova, very important organization that's monitoring this information in Moldova for many, many years, I've been in contact with them about the fact that social media is not doing much for them, is not banning enough, soon enough or quickly enough, the media, because in the beginning of the war, WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, and so on, were focused on not letting disinformation spread in Ukraine. But in the back of this, in Moldova, the disinformation just exploded. And they didn't have enough people or time or information or whatever to handle it. So we had to reach to them in all the channels possible to say, hey, these are days when a country can be destabilized. This is a country that could really go bad in just a few weeks. Some people say that this was very well coordinated campaign of disinformation targeting Moldova. And as we saw a month or two later, when the subject of Moldova really appeared in the public, it's a very key country. It's small, but it's in a key position, smashed between Romania and Ukraine, but a country which, if falls in the bad direction, it could provide a very important bridge for the Russian troops. So it's very, very important what's happening there. And I think the Russians knew more and better than we did in the beginning of the war how important Moldova is. But I feel like now more people are looking in its direction. I hope, at least.
How are the Moldovan government responding to all this disinformation online?
I think it's the worst thing that possible could happen to them, except being invaded or being in a war. It's a very good government, a very promising government that brought a wave of hope to people. And then they suddenly were not just near a war, a country in war, but they are in certain ways conditioned by Russia with gas and everything they supply there. And in the same time, a huge wave of refugees were coming. And that people had to be fed, had to be hosted, had to receive first aid in the poorest country in Europe. So they found themselves pretty much alone in the beginning and had to react to all of this and also to the disinformation campaign, which was huge, and wanted to put people against Ukrainians to convince them not to help them. Because in Moldova, most of the Ukrainians are hosted by Moldovans. I think they could have done better. I think the ban of discussing about Russia and Russian propaganda in the TV stations is good. I don't think it's enough. They try to reach out to social media owners, and they are asking for help now, and they are trying to do their best. They banned the Z symbol, which is a very brave movement from them, and the orange and black ribbon that could have backfired very easily because everybody was looking not just on Russia on the 9th of May, but also on Moldova on that day, because that was the day when a lot of rumors were spread that an attack would start in Moldova. That revolution, let's say, pushed by the banning of the symbol could start. And I saw in Bucharest, in Romania, many, many, many Moldovans who were probably running away for the weekend because anything was possible at that point. If Moldova falls, at least falls in the arms of disinformation harder than it already did, it's a huge, huge problem for Europe in general, because it could shift the way in which the war will look like.
In a worst case scenario, the effects of this kind of misinformation spreading en masse among young people in Moldova and Moldovans in general, what does that worst case scenario look like? How does it change the shape of the war?
The worst case scenario would be for people to throw the government, the current government, which is very, very pro-European, pro-Western, pro-peace, and put a pro-Russian government instead. And that could allow weapons or attacks to take place from Moldova to Ukraine by Russian troops. So to be a place like Belarus was a place where the troops can stay, from where they can attack. Then also the danger everybody was afraid of and still is afraid of is Transnistria, which is an unrecognized separatist region in the east of Moldova, bordering Ukraine. and where are already, if I'm not mistaken, 1,000 Russian troops are there, and tanks and military equipment. And it's a key point if you want to get Odessa, because it's like 2 hours away from Odessa. So this is the worst case scenario. Troops invading Ukraine also from Moldova or from Transnistria region and targeting, I would say, most likely Odessa and trying to cut off Ukraine completely from the access to the Black Sea. And that would be a catastrophe. Romania, a NATO country, will be bordering Russia. It would just make the situation more dangerous for everyone, not just for Ukraine or just for Moldova. It would be a really on fire situation. And definitely, as a long term, this would cut Moldova out of any possible EU membership, any possible integration in any European or pro-Western or whatever you want to call them, structures, because that would definitely be a point of no return.
And so in terms of the work you're doing in Moldova now, are you finding that these young people are responsive to your ideas, or is there suspicion of you even?
I think those who have suspicions in general about any pro-Western, I don't think we can convince them. So my advice is that when you're trying to do this in a country which is controversial, you should first try to talk to your base, to the people who are already convinced of that. And if you can reach out through those people to talk to others, that's amazing. The people who are convinced that Romania is doing harm in Moldova or the Westerners are doing harm in Moldova, it will be very hard to convince them otherwise. But at least if we can make them question a TikTok video, then it's a huge step. But at this level in Moldova, without the intervention of the social media owners, let's say, we're like fighting windmills. It's futile. They have to take a stand and intervene. I mean, in TikTok, there is no hope for them to filter in any way what's going on there, but at least from Meta and from the channels which we can influence pro-democracy. Otherwise, it's just wasting time. So my approach right now for Moldova and also for Romania is more to get correctly informed the people. And if they also see this information, just to say a second and say, I read the opposite there. Maybe I can Google it to see who's right.
I really hope some people with some power in Brussels or some people that work for tech giants were listening to that interview, because it feels quite existential, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So please share that interview with your powerful friends in Brussels and the tech giants listeners.
Swedish or otherwise.
Swedish or otherwise. Thank you very much to Alban from Allianz Kulturstiftung for putting us in touch with Diana. You can find out more about her work at forumapolum.ro. The link is in the show notes. Time for a bit of culture.
What have you been enjoying this week, Katie?
I watched a beautiful documentary this week called The Truffle Hunters. Have you seen it?
Oh, no, but I've heard about it. Kat, our producer, was raving about it a few months ago.
Oh, it's so nice. It's a couple of years old now. I think it came out in 2020. But it's about a group of old men in Piemonte in Italy, or Piedmont, I think we say in English. And these old men are truffle hunters in the Italian countryside. They make their living by looking for these really rare and delicious white truffles, these very fancy, expensive fungus. And it's just a beautiful film. It's shot in a way that really makes it feel like the camera isn't there. So you feel like you've got this secret glimpse into other people's lives, which I guess is what all the best documentaries do. And in this case, you're watching some people who are at the end of their careers and they're questioning their mortality in some cases. And the film looks at this crazy truffle industry and how at one end you've got people who live pretty simply in a very rural area of Italy. And at the other end of the industry, when it ends up on the table for thousands of euros per kilo, it's like the most ridiculous luxury industry you can imagine. And the film also touches on this really grim trend of some hunters laying down poison to poison their rivals' dogs and kill them.
Oh.
Because the amounts of money at stake are just so high. But that grim side aside, there's some really lovely characters in the film. And the way that it shows a really intimate relationship between these elderly truffle hunters and the dogs who help them find the truffles is pretty adorable. If you're in the UK or you have access to British television, it is on the BBC iPlayer right now as part of the Storyville series. But I think it's rentable in lots of different countries via a few different streaming services. Including Amazon Prime.
Sounds great. I need to watch it.
What have you been enjoying this week?
I spent some time this week reading the enormous New York Times investigation into Haiti and their complicated history with France.
Yes.
You may know that Haiti was a French colony until they had the world's first successful slave revolution in 1791, with the country establishing an independent nation in 1804. Sadly, things got pretty bad quite quickly after that, as the country was then forced to pay huge ransom payments to their former slave masters in order to hold off another war, a ransom which they paid off by taking out loans with French banks. And it meant that the country was paying what is referred to as like a double debt, the money for the ransom and the money to these French banks. And it's something that the New York Times team have spent more than a year investigating and asking questions like, what if this nation had not been looted by outside powers, by foreign banks, and even by its own leaders? One fact stood out to me. Experts believe that if Haiti had not been forced to pay its French former slave masters all this money, the country could have been almost six times as wealthy as it is today. It's a long read, but I really recommend spending some time learning about this history if you don't know it already. It's available in French, English, and Creole, and there's also a shorter summary if you don't have time to read the long read. And it's looking like this high-profile reporting is waking some people up to this shameful history, and one of the French banks involved in this loan said that they will hire researchers to look into what they did in Haiti. Who knows if it will lead to anything concrete, but it's definitely made more people aware of the problem.
It's been quite controversial as a piece of reporting though, hasn't it? Like, I know it sparked a lot of debate amongst historians who spoke to the New York Times along the many months of this piece of reporting and then didn't get credited.
Oh, really? I'd missed that.
Yeah, and some of them saying that, like, they presented it as a kind of scoop, but actually it's, you know, it's all stuff that people have been studying with PhDs and academic careers for a really long time. So there's been a lot of like really interesting reflection on it in the sort of like what the relationship between academics and journalists should be. But I think the most sort of measured takes on this are saying it's still a really, really impressive and important piece of reporting. But I mean, it's not an exclusive, you know, it's just a really impressive piece of reporting.
Yeah, I didn't really read it as if it was an exclusive. You're right. There are some bits where they talk about how much they've like looked into all these documents that haven't been looked at by anyone for centuries and maybe that isn't necessary. It kind of is trying to make it seem more sensational than it is. But I still think they packaged the information really well. And as ever with these big New York Times pieces, it's got beautiful visuals. And if you look at it on your phone, on the app, it's designed so well and it makes it really easy to understand, I think. So yeah, some people did a good job, but clearly that's bad if they didn't credit people correctly.
To be fair to them, they have also reported on the controversy around the reporting itself. So fair play to them. And yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
Happy ending. I read this week about a pretty amazing accidental scientific discovery that took place in some lobster and crab pots off the coast of the UK.
Okay.
Scientists were working on a project to see if there was a way that they could lure crab and lobster into these pots underwater without having to use poor little fishies as bait. The thing that they decided to try out was placing lights in pots underwater to see if the crab or lobster would be attracted to the light source. It didn't work. And that could be the end of the story. It would be quite a shit happy ending. But it's a great happy ending because whilst the crab and lobster weren't more attracted to the traps and lights, another creature was the European king scallop. The researchers, much to their surprise and amazement, discovered a huge number of these scallops in the pots with lights. 518 scallops in 985 pots with lights, compared to only 2 scallops in the 901 control pots that didn't have any lights. One of the scientists described it to The Guardian as being like a scallop disco, which makes this sound really fun and happy, but let's be honest, it's a disco, which you can't get out of, and once the lights go out, you're going to be eaten.
Delicious, though. Do we know why these scallops like the light so much?
Do you pronounce it scallops?
I say scallops, which I think is less posh than scallops. Oh, I think you're fancy.
I texted my parents to be like, how do we pronounce this word again?
Your parents come from a nicer town than mine do.
Well, I read somewhere that the people that actually fish them call them scallops.
Ah, well, there you go.
Anyway, we don't really know why they like the lights for sure, but we do know that scallops have amazing eyes. In fact, they have up to 200 of them.
What?
According to Dr. Bryce Stewart, who is speaking to The Guardian, unlike most animals, their eyes don't have lenses. They have mirrors at the back of them, and they have 2 retinas, one for lighter things and one for darker things.
Where are the eyes? On the shell somewhere?
Just on the inside of the shell.
Oh, weird.
Bryce thought that maybe they were attracted to the light because illuminated areas provide safety from predators, or because it's easier to find the plankton they eat. But little did these scallops know. You see, I've now started saying scallops. Little did these scallops know they were dancing their shells towards their death.
That's my other question, actually. How do they move? Because they're shells.
You have to watch the video. I'm going to post the little video because it really is like they're dancing because they're shells. They move by opening and closing.
Wow, a little scallop shuffle.
Yeah, I realize it might sound brutal to be celebrating a development in the capturing of any animal, but the main reason why this is such happy news is because fishing for scallops is usually really bad for marine habitats. They are most commonly caught by dredging, which can be really awful for the environment. And this new research opens up the possibility that scallops could be caught in a way that is way less damaging for our underwater world and way cheaper than the other options for more sustainable scallop catching, which is, I think, sending down scuba divers to pick them by hand. So it's a party time for the European king scallops.
Ending in their death.
Yes.
That is it for this week. If you would like to see some photographic evidence of our trip to Berlin, there are some pics on our Instagram at Europeans Podcast. And if it is videos of the European Tram Driving Championship that you're interested in, you'd better take a look at our Twitter at Europeans Pod.
This show is produced by my co-host Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak. Our other producer, Katz Laszlo, is in the North Sea right now, lucky thing.
We are members of the Are We Europe family. You can find more European podcasts at the link in the show notes. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.